KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The earliest it could be approved would be July. An effort to streamline the regulatory process for small hydropower dams is generating a rare moment of bipartisanship in Congress. Two bills sailed through a Senate committee on Wednesday. They've already passed the House. Correspondent Jessica Robinson has details.
Whatever gridlock exists elsewhere, it didn't show up in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes have it in S-545.
Senators from the hydropower-rich Northwest helped lead the charge. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, Washington Democrats Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, and Idaho Republicans Jim Risch and Mike Crapo. Washington Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers backed the companion bill in the House. Neil Naruzzo of the Snohomish County Public Utility District says it doesn't make sense for small local hydropower projects to jump through the same hoops as mega dams.
These projects we feel we can develop in a way that's environmentally benign. Oftentimes they're built above natural barriers to fish that are migrating, above waterfalls.
A related bill would make it easier to generate hydropower in irrigation canals and pipelines overseen by the Bureau of Reclamation. That could include several in southern Idaho. I'm Jessica Robinson reporting.
Today's weather forecast, a lot like what we've seen the past couple of days. Clouds in the morning and then sun in the afternoon. Currently, it's 53 degrees in Seattle, and we're expecting to get up to 73 later. Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:06.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle and KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. Coming up this hour, we're going to explore what it means to be a genius. I looked up the definition yesterday, and you'd be surprised how nebulous and ungenius-like that could be. We're also going to get a tip for a good lunch from Sarah Dickerman. This is Bike to Work Month, and with all the great weather, chances are you've cleaned your bicycle and you're already pedaling all around on it. And you probably think that that bike helmet that you may wear keeps you safe. Well, you'd be wrong. Most bicycle helmets prevent skull fractures, but they do not prevent concussion. As a result, bike deaths are down, but concussions and other brain injuries are on the rise. Bruce Barcott's a writer based on Bainbridge Island. He's contributing editor at Outside Magazine, a frequent contributor to Bicycling Magazine, along with other publications. And Bruce Barcott, you've just written a long exploratory article about bicycle helmets. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, Marcy. Thanks for having me on.
So this exploration started with buying a bicycle helmet for your daughter.
Yeah, about a year ago, my daughter needed a new helmet, so she and I went into the local bike shop, and we're looking at this wall of helmets, and I was wondering, well, listen, which is a safer helmet? You know, they range in price from like $40 to about $200. And the guys in the shop said, well, you know, they really all pass the same government safety standards, so the difference in price is really about styling and comfort. And I thought that was really strange. I thought, you know, we can buy all sorts of different kinds of cough syrup or potato chips or anything, but they all are just, you know, have the same safety level. So I started talking with a friend of mine who's an editor at Bicycling, and he said, well, you know, there's always been this sort of confusion about bike helmets and concussions. He said, well, why don't you actually go out there and take some time and look into what's going on. And it took me about a year to figure out what was going on.
Well, let's start with government certified. There are stickers on my bike helmet has a sticker. What does that mean?
That means that the helmets that are sold in the U.S. are not junk. And let me say, keep wearing your helmet.
Okay.
It does you a lot of good. I put it this way. Conventional bike helmets are like seat belts. You'd be foolish not to put them on. But what we need are airbags as well. So government certification started about 15 years ago when the bike helmet movement first started. And it started really here in Seattle with some doctors who did a lot of pioneering studies on bike helmets. And a lot of people said, well, listen, we want to get more people to wear helmets, but we want them, the helmets to be actually decent. You know, we don't want a bunch of junk out there. So the government got together, Congress passed a law, and they told the Consumer Product Safety Commission to come up with a standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did in the mid-90s. The problem is that standard has not changed since the mid-90s. It was basically built around the helmets that existed then. And that standard, because it hasn't and really can't change, has kept helmet designers from making new innovative work with new materials and new design systems. And so we're sort of stuck in the mid-90s. We're all wearing really nice versions of the old Model T.
So the helmet that I have has a kind of a shell, a hard plastic shell, and some kind of foamy stuff inside.
Yeah, it's a hard plastic shell. The foamy stuff is called extruded polystyrene. In the industry, it's known as EPS. And EPS is actually really good in terms of preventing fractures to your skull. The problem is that there's sort of a disconnect between medical research and the government standard and bicycle manufacturers. Medical researchers have known for a long time that fractures to the skull are bad, but they don't really have much to do with concussions. Fractures to the skull are the result of sort of a linear, straight-on impact to the skull where it breaks the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And concussions happen when the head hits and the brain sort of inside the skull has a little spin to it. And the brain is sort of like, it's not hard like a nut inside a shell, it's more like tofu. So that spin breaks axons in the brain, and that's what causes concussion.
So why can't a bike helmet protect against that?
Because basically your skull is, when it hits the ground, it's kind of latching on to that EPS, the foamy stuff inside, and so all of that spin force goes to the brain. And what doctors and researchers in the helmet field are trying to do is figure out a system where some of that spin can sort of be absorbed by the helmet itself.
Are people in the helmet industry looking at ways to redesign a helmet that could protect against concussion?
It's funny. They have been, but it hasn't been a huge priority for them for a couple of reasons. Number one, the government standard doesn't demand it. Number two, there's sort of an assumption that customers won't demand greater safety from their helmets. I think none of us had a whole lot of concern about concussions until recently with all the National Football League studies, and they weren't sure that they could actually do anything about it. But so where the research has come out has been more from the medical field. There's a group out at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, which is the place that gives out the Nobel Prizes for medicine, and they came up with a system that's essentially this really thin liner that when your head hits, the liner allows the skull to spin a little, and that takes some of the pressure off the brain. It's not a concussion-proof system, but it brings down that spin to a level where you have much less risk of getting a concussion.
So what you're saying is it is possible to build a better helmet.
It is possible to build a better helmet, and they're just now coming on the market. You know, a couple of companies have taken the chance and put this in just a few models that are on the market now. A company called Scott USA. Scott's kind of best known for its bicycles, but they do make helmets. And they've just introduced two models with this system. It's called the MIPS system, M-I-P-S. And they're sort of tentatively rolling it out. You know, it can be hard to find the helmet, and not a lot of stores carry them. But it's up to us as bicycle riders to go out and find this thing. Switching over my family to MIPS system helmets as a result of all the research I've done. We are now wearing ski helmets with the MIPS system in it, and my son and I actually bought new hockey helmets a couple months ago with something similar in it.
We're talking with Bruce Barcott, and his article on helmets, you can read the whole thing at the June issue of Bicycling Magazine or through Bruce's website, brucebarcott.com. Well, so these MIPS helmets I'm imagining some huge thing on top of my head, you know.
Right, and that's the problem. That's what a lot of helmet makers and helmet safety experts imagine and fear as well. The great fear among helmet safety people is like, look, we can make a really, really safe helmet, but it looked like a massive mushroom on his head. Nobody would wear it.
Yeah.
The thing about the MIPS system is it's about as thick as, you know, 5 sheets of paper. It's really thin. I've got a MIPS ski helmet, like I said, and you cannot tell the difference between it and a normal helmet. You know, the only difference is the MIPS model will cost about $40 more. And it takes some doing to move people, you know,
right
up that $40 ladder. And that's a concern for helmet makers as well.
Well, let me go back to government standards. If they haven't changed in at least 15 years, what, in your mind, you believe that they should be more stringent, I think?
I think they should be more stringent, and actually they should be more open to change. I mean, one of the problems is there's actually a really good committee of helmet experts that meets twice a year, and they update their own standard. It's an organization called ASTM, and they have their own standard for helmets, and helmet makers, you know, who want to make better helmets have that sticker as in addition to the CPSC sticker on their helmet. But no helmet maker has to do what the ASTM recommends. And the problem is the government standard, they have to meet such a high bar in terms of the cost-benefit analysis that it's not worth it for them to try. I talked to people at the CPSC, and they're frustrated. They look.
That's
the
Consumer Product Safety Commission.
Right, right. You know, they're trying to get a safety rule on table saws, and they've been trying to do that for 8 years, and they can't do that. So I would look. You know, that is really not going to be the answer. I think the answer is going to be people getting themselves educated about concussions and going out and looking for these helmets and buying them. I think the market is going to make the change here.
Well, I hate to bring in the litigious part of our society, but if these helmet manufacturers started getting sued a lot by people who had concussions, would that force them to change their standards?
I don't know. I think actually one of the questions I asked in the article was, look, if this medical research is out there and has been out there for quite some time, what's the problem? What's the hang-up? And one of the hang-ups is our litigious society, is that, you know, there are so many sports concussion lawsuits out there already that there's a monthly newsletter just devoted to the field. And helmet makers are really, really leery of using the C word. They won't say concussion in any of their new systems because that really, I think they believe, opens them up to lawsuits. So it's a hard thing for them to do. They want to make a safer helmet. I mean, they do. I went down and spent a day at the Giro factory down near Santa Cruz in California. These are all, you know, lifelong bike riders, and they're really into their work. They want to make safer helmets, but they can't quite make a safer helmet and actually advertise it as safer because of legal concerns.
Hmm. And just a last question. You said you got these MIPS helmets for your whole family. Are they easy to find?
You know, it's funny. They're ski helmets with the MIPS system are easy to find. REI has them today in their store or online. They're made by Burton. It's a well-known maker, and they're pretty easy to find. Bike helmets are just coming to the market now. The company is called Scott USA. They have a model called the Tall, T-A-A-L, and it goes for about $75 to $100. You can find them at a Scott dealer or online. There's also a helmet that doesn't use the MIPS system, but it's for hockey players. It's one my son and I use. It's called the Messier helmet, M-E-S-S-I-E-R.
After the hockey player.
After Mark Messier, the hockey player, exactly. And that kind of works on a similar type of idea. But you kind of got to look for them, and I think it's worth it, though.
Bruce Barcott, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
Bruce Barcott's a writer based on Bainbridge Island. His article about bicycle helmet safety is in the June issue of Bicycling Magazine. This is KUOW.
Ten 19. How do you define genius? We'll take that up in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Old West town of Winthrop, Washington, with outdoor recreational opportunities including the Metow Valley Rodeo, May 25th and 26th, close to Seattle via the scenic North Cascades Highway. Lodging and recreational information at winthropwashington.com.
53 degrees in Seattle and pretty well socked in. Forecast says it's going to turn sunny later, and we expect to reach 73 degrees. Then it's clear sky overnight with a low of 53 and mostly sunny tomorrow, Friday, with a high of 79. In the early days of radio, everything was performed live. The music, the radio plays, everything, live all the time. Then tape was invented, and things could be recorded. We'll find out how the use of recording technology changed radio in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. What does it mean when you call somebody a genius? I looked it up, and according to Wikipedia, there's no scientifically precise definition. The Oxford dictionaries say a genius is a person of exceptional intellectual or creative capacity or, and I'm quoting here, some other natural ability, which means, I guess, that genius is in the eye of the beholder. For the last 10 years, the newspaper The Stranger has handed out genius awards in a number of artistic fields. The newspaper is poised to announce its genius finalists, and that makes The Stranger the logical place to turn as we try to fill in the blanks about what it makes to be a genius. So here in the studios are Christopher Frizzell, who's editor of The Stranger, and The Stranger's visual arts editor, who I might term genius, Jen Graves. Thanks for coming in.
I think you're a genius too, Jen.
I think you're a genius. You too, Marcy.
So, Christopher, when you started the Genius Awards, the name was sort of tongue-in-cheek, right?
It was, and we used an expletive on the cake that announced that you were on the genius shortlist or that you had become a genius. It said, "You're an expletive genius."
An expletive genius.
Yes.
And we'll just, it's an effing. We can say effing here.
Oh, that's very nice.
An effing genius.
But it's, there's something to the word, too, that calls attention to itself. It sounds kind of like what we meant. So we meant it tongue-in-cheek, but we also meant it seriously.
So when you think of that word, and this is the 11th year, if I'm not mistaken, of geniusdom.
That's right.
You know, we have the MacArthur Genius Awards. They don't call them the Genius Awards, but right. We stick that word genius in there. So I had to look it up, and it is the most nebulous definition. So in your minds, Jen, when you, I don't know if you ever call anybody a genius, but if you did, what would that be?
Well, there's the kind of unfortunate sort of classical definition of like the lone artist who's both kind of the age perfectly and then also transcends the age. And, you know, and that's a really unfortunate sort of Western based tradition. But there's also kind of a way in which it really is something that you just feel. And the nebulousness is not unrelated, I think. I mean, the fact that the MacArthur Genius Grants, I mean, we don't apply sort of strict categories. We don't apply strict, you know, definitions. And I think, you know, it's just something we're thinking about this morning. And I was saying it feels a little bit like when I see somebody who's making things continuously that feel like a part of my heart is outside of me. And people say that about their kids, but I feel that about other people's works of art.
Uh-huh. So something that stops you in your tracks.
Yeah, or removes your head and flies away with it, as I call it.
Wow.
You know, it's the art that keeps you up late at night. It's the stuff that gets under your skin that you keep trying to communicate about because you're trying to figure it out.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
You can only talk about it in cliches.
Well, obviously, I mean, seriously, when I looked it up yesterday, that was so interesting that, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary, which is, you know, genius in and of itself, I think that people would sit around and think of definitions, had no definition for genius. But we use that word not just when it applies to art, but we'll say, oh, she's it made me think of a line from a movie that I make my family watch every year. It's a Wonderful Life at Christmas time where, you know, Jimmy Stewart's brother, the character's brother, marries somebody and she goes, oh, he's a genius at plastics or something. So you could be a genius at pie baking, or you could be a genius at hopscotch, or you could be a genius at, you know, making jam. I mean, you could be a genius at, you guys happen to, I mean, you didn't pick the Genius News Awards, you picked arts, because
right.
Do we tend to think of genius in the world of art more?
Well, also, great art often exists outside of the market, and it needs a different kind of support. So that's one of the things we're thinking about, too. How do we give not just recognition, but also material support to these people who make fantastic work and are fascinating? And I would be remiss if I didn't say we couldn't do this without Snoqualmie Tribe Fund and Alaska Airlines Signature Visa, who have made it possible to give this material support to these people whose work doesn't really exist in the marketplace sometimes.
When you think about Genius here, I mean, you guys both live here, but I know Jen is from a different state. You're from the East Coast. Is there are there geniuses in the Northwest that might not be genius if they were in New York City?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I think
how does the region affect it, do you think?
The way it affects everything else, right? Like, a place is a place. No two places are the same place. Otherwise, place wouldn't be a thing, right? I mean, that for me is a quick one. But, I mean...
So for past geniuses mm-hmm. that you guys have selected, mm-hmm. are there people that you think are just super tied to the Northwest that might not, their genius might not have shown if they had been somewhere else?
Well,
who might those be?
Yeah. I sort of feel like every artist who works here and is kind of at that level of like connecting so deeply with the people who live here are of here. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like that's something that any of the geniuses don't have. You know, I feel like some of them are like overt about it.
Right.
Right.
Or you think about an artist like Susan Robb, who's responding to the environment in a way that someone who lived in a different place might not be responding in the same way. Mm-hmm. Or a Sherman Alexie, who grew up on a reservation in Spokane. Those are people whose work is about this place. It's not just created here. It's also about it.
Yeah.
Do you guys have set categories for these genius awards, or are they fluid every year depending on which genii pop up?
Both. We do have a literature category and a film category and an art category and a theater category and a music category. But sometimes, you know, someone who makes video work, it could be a video artist or it could be a filmmaker, and we adjust the categories depending on who's making work right now that we just can't stop talking about.
I would bet that there's more than however many you just named off, more than that, a number of people that could be genius in any given year or, you know, remain genius.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a silliness, you know, just picking one. But, you know, if you look at the history of the awards, it's really fascinating. I mean, the structure of the awards will tell you a lot about what we think about genius, right, and how we define it and how we don't define it, how we refuse to define it.
How have you been at The Stranger, Jen, the entire decade?
But no. I have.
You have. So how have you refined who you're looking at over that period of time?
Well, last year we decided, why don't we talk about three times the number of artists? And why don't we have a summer-long conversation about art? So instead of just the critics sit around and duke it out and raise our voices and, you know, storm out of the room and eventually come to a decision about five Genius Award winners, why don't we choose 15 fascinating artists who are all deserving and then commence a conversation throughout the course of the summer about their work and what it means and why they're doing it and what we take away from it?
This isn't one of those public vote things. You don't win by popular acclaim, do you?
No. It's voted on by the critics at The Stranger and also people who've won previously in that category and other Genius Award categories.
So that's the selection.
So, yeah, there is a process where other artists get to weigh in, too.
They're a league of geniuses, sort of.
The Genius League, uh-huh. selecting geniuses.
Everybody who's won a Genius Award is eligible to vote in that year's categories. And we sort of, you know, remind artists, although you don't have to remind artists to be conscientious about art, just to get to understand what the work is. Say you're a filmmaker and you don't know visual art that well. That's why we hold events in the summer that are showcases. Like, hey, you can come and at this summer it'll be at the Fry. You can come and learn more about this work and decide which way you want to cast your vote. So we sort of eliminated certain elements of like private arbitrariness that happened in our offices and introduced new elements of slightly less private arbitrariness.
Well, because isn't genius in the eye of the beholder? I mean, to some extent.
Is it
subjective or objective? Yeah,
but well, it's not objective. But the you know what we're doing is saying that we're going to put funds behind the idea that we're going to pick somebody, and the way that developed was that the you know the way that funding developed in this country is that the NEA used to give individual artist grants and completely stopped doing it, and these awards were part of the response to that. You know that we're going to give awards that are totally unrestricted and that also aren't medium-based. Like, don't give an award to a painter. Give an award. Like, the NETI awards are to a painter and a...
And those are existing arts awards,
Those are existing arts awards, but this one is different in that the funds are unrestricted and they're not in any category. And unrestricted is important, too, because it means that you don't have to do the sort of United Way nonprofit measurable thing that you achieved. You know, we don't say, here's some money, prove to us what you made. Hmm. Right. It's not project based. It's not. And project based is sort of the trendy thing now. But it's like it is really an unusual award.
So, Christopher, to go back to the idea that this is the 11th year, you mentioned that you changed the process. So this process this year will be the same. You've come up with how many people?
15.
15?
Yeah.
You want to tell us some of them?
Sure. We have a lot of fantastic people. And one of the great things about the Genius Awards is that it's artists at all different levels of their career.
Oh.
So sometimes it's very established people with people you've never heard of. And putting them in a conversation about what they do and why they do it is one of the fun parts about the showcases that we're going to do this summer at the Fry. For example, in the literature category, you have someone like Neal Stephenson, who's a well-known sci-fi writer who writes about the way that human beings and technology interact and the problems it creates. And then a poet like Maged Zaher, who's from Egypt and is constantly going back there and writing about, you know, the intersection of the personal and the political.
But who lives here.
But who
and
lives
is
here.
An information technologist here.
And is hilarious.
An information technologist?
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what that is.
We don't really either.
Okay.
And then the third group in that category is actually an organization called April Festival, which is completely revolutionizing the way that literary events happen in the city. So you have a poet, you have a sci-fi novelist, and you have an organization. And the three of them get to talk about the culture of the literary arts in the city.
And that's the great part about the way that this works, as opposed to picking one person, is you get to have a conversation about what you think is genius. Which of those three things do you think deserve rewarding this year?
Okay.
And it's true that it is in the eye of the beholder, and the people that are beholding them are the staff, you know, the opinionated, hard-to-please staff at The Stranger who eat, sleep, and breathe Seattle art.
But then these former geniuses join you. Do they temper what your opinions are?
Well, they outnumber the crap out of us.
Okay.
And what they do is they make the conversation more interesting. They pull the conversation in directions that a critic might not necessarily think to go.
Absolutely.
So that has meant that these awards that started tongue in cheek but very much wanted to reward people for what they produce and what they think about and what they create has taken a sort of a quantum leap into something that is a little bit more objective, if there is such a thing, because you've opened it up from your opinions.
Yeah, yeah. We tried to make it a little bit more open to the community and what other artists are doing, and make it more cross-disciplinary, and make it more sustainable. And part of making it sustainable is finding creative new ways to fund it. Right now, we're turning wine into art by having a kid from Kent donate all this wine that then we tell the story of certain Genius Award winners on the label. So when you get the wine, you can learn about an artist in the city, and then that goes to fund next year's award.
So, Jen,
we should say, we haven't said yet, each artist gets $5,000.
All?
Each one, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a significant outlay of money.
And who are you most excited about on this roster?
Well, you know, there are two categories that that come to mind in terms of thinking about what's interesting this year. I think the theater performance dance category is essentially a dance category this year.
And really?
Yeah. It's Zoe Schofield.
Three choreographers.
Zoe Schofield, Pat Graney, and Amy O'Neill. And they're all very different. And so the idea is to really dig in and figure out what kind of work dance artists are making right now in the city and really develop that idea.
So at this presentation at the Fry, will they perform?
They won't, but there will be video of their work, and there'll be an onstage conversation with a critic at The Stranger.
Them. And then in art, you know, of course I'm interested in art. Rodrigo Valenzuela is a video artist, and he is totally different from Sherry Markowitz, who makes paintings on silk, you know, and then we have also Matt Offenbacher, who's essentially just a painter and a writer and an organizer, and very, very, very different. You know, the three of them could not be more different.
Over the years, then, you have awarded, if I do my math right, 50 Genius Awards?
Something like that, yeah.
We had a party last year. It was packed.
So, you know, what does this say about the city of Seattle that you have a continual pool to choose from?
it says that there's a lot of great art being made here, and there's a lot of support for it. There's a lot of people who believe that, you know, keeping great art alive is an essential part of the city.
And that is another question I have, because it a lot of times these conversations about artists in various forms end up being conversations among other artists in various forms, and the city itself maybe doesn't take heed. So what role do you have as a newspaper when you award these things in making this more accessible, I guess? I hate to use that word, but it's the only one that comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, the June 6th edition of our Art and Performance Quarterly, A&P, which is a quarterly glossy magazine, is entirely given over to talking about these artists and what makes them fascinating. So that lives on the newsstands for 3 months. And that kind of commences the conversation. But then we also have these Fry events. We also have a big kind of infamous cross-disciplinary party at the Moore Theater this year on September 28th.
And so is that when the five?
Yeah, and they're announced from stage. None of us knows.
Really?
Who wins. No.
So it's just like the Academy Awards?
The business manager at the Stranger tallies them. Yeah.
Really?
We all learn when they're announced.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but so, no Seth MacFarlane. It's like the Academy Awards except
good.
For that guy.
That's my opinion added. Good. Where can people find the names of the finalists?
If you go to our blog, Slog, right now, slog.thestranger.com, you will see all of the finalists from this year receiving their cakes that let them know that they're on the shortlist. Winners and shortlisters are notified via cake, historically, in the Genius Award tradition. And there's photos up right now of all of them receiving their cakes this year.
When you look back on all these geniuses that I just mentioned, who do you think has continued, or have all of them continued to prove that you were right to pick them?
They're amazing. They continue. You get news about them constantly. I mean, I find myself reading about an artist who's working in a nursing home making a project. Susie Lee was doing that. You find, Alex Schwader, Law now is his name, working in Berlin and then showing at SF MoMA, making these crazy breathing, moving architectures. I mean, you hear about them everywhere. They all are amazing.
I think about Lynn Shelton, who got a Genius Award after a feature that not very many people saw. And since her Genius Award, she's, you know, become probably the filmic voice of the city. Yeah.
And I think of Hollywood as well
yeah.
at this point in time.
Yeah.
She's actually been successful in her career. Mm. Well, we'll look at Slog for the complete list. And then the Fry event is
5 weeks in a row.
Yeah, it's the last two Wednesdays of July and the first three Wednesdays of August.
Every Wednesday, free.
Yeah.
Free is good. Christopher Frizzell is the editor of The Stranger. Jen Graves is The Stranger's visual arts editor. And thanks for at least trying to fill in the blanks for what the definition of a genius is through your eyes.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
In a minute here, we're going to find out how the advent of recording technology changed radio back in the day. That's right around the corner.
Evening tours of KUOW's broadcast facility are now available to listeners ages 15 and older. This month's evening tour is Thursday, May 16th at 6:15 p.m. Space is limited. To schedule a tour, call 206-543-2710 or email tours@kuow.org.
Still pretty cloudy over Seattle, and there's fog in some areas, but the National Weather Service assures us that we're going to see the sun this afternoon, and we're going to go from our current temperature of 53 degrees all the way up to 73.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington Energy Services, featuring energy-efficient products since 1957 to fit individual home, lifestyle, and budget. Windows, heating and cooling systems, water heaters, and more. Products, installation, and service information online at WashingtonEnergy.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. What's for lunch? If you're thinking to yourself, I have no idea, well, stick around. Food writer Sarah Dickerman has an idea for you in 15 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
There's Orson Welles, still speaking to us. And here I am, still speaking to you, even though I'm supposed to be on professional leave. How is that possible? Ah, my friends, the magic of radio, right, Katie Sewell?
It's the magic of tape. Yeah. That's what it is, Steve.
It is the magic of recording things and coming back. Right now, I'm actually at home listening to this with you. You're, Katie Sewell, you're at work.
I'm at work.
But you and I, we're just listening to this on the radio.
I know, and it's lovely, too, because even though we taped this, nobody's heard it on the radio yet. Now, in the golden age of radio, that wouldn't have been possible. During the early days, everything then was live. Music, drama, comedy, soap operas, all live. If a popular show played, as you well know, Steve, on the East Coast and then on the West Coast, that meant the actors performed the script live twice. And starting in the early 30s, the radio industry started using transcription discs to record material. A transcriptive disc was like a phonographic record, but it only held 15 to 20 minutes of audio, and sometimes it played from the inside to the outside, which is kind of interesting.
Well, I didn't know
reverse
that.
Records. But most networks had an outright ban on using a disc on the air. They thought that the sound quality was just too shabby. I thought it would be fun to actually take a listen to what a transcription disc recording actually sounds like. This is a familiar news report. The only exception to the ban, NBC temporarily lifted their ban to play this report in 1937.
The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It's burst into flames. Get it started. It's rising terrible.
People thought that was live when it happened, right? Because of the way he had, even though it happened on the radio, what, a day later? Many hours later, because they had to send it back to the city.
Yeah, I don't remember the timing, but you can tell that it doesn't sound live. So it's possible that people thought it was recorded.
Because of all the crackly sound and
all the scratching.
The poor quality of the recording, right?
Yeah, and of course that's Herb Morrison, right? We have to give the man credit for reporting on the crash of the Hindenburg using a transcription disc. NBC, of course, reinstated their ban on using these discs on the air immediately after this report was aired. These discs actually did become kind of commonplace, though, during World War II, because the studios started sending their shows all over the world so that U.S. Armed Forces radio service had something to play. And believe it or not, we have the war to thank for advances in audio recording.
We have the war to thank for so much.
So many things. So during the war, we started noticing that German officials were somehow able to broadcast themselves in multiple time zones at once without making their speeches live over and over again, something we were not currently able to do. And at first, people assumed, okay, they're using a transcription disc like we do. But then again, they sounded so much better. They sounded like they were live. And what we discovered the answer was is that the Germans had invented magnetic tape.
Really?
And we brought that technology back to the United States in the late 1940s. Now, that, however, did not change the attitude of the network executives on the radio. They still wanted everything to be live. So sometimes, you know, when stubbornness is happening in the radio station, it takes one man of talent to change everything for good. And it was this man in the case of radio.
Tomorrow.
A little Dear Bingle, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I'll be whispering your name and the day after forever. I know.
Now, Bing Crosby was a big star on the radio and in movies, frankly, but he didn't like being stuck to the studio schedule of performing a weekly live broadcast 39 times a year. That would keep him in the same place for far too long and far too often. So he asked the networks if he could please record the 1944 and 45 season onto transcription discs, and they refused. So he stopped doing the program that
oh, really?
Year.
Yeah. He just said, I'm done.
He's like, well, I'm out of here. For the 1946 and 47 season, the network did agree to let him record it, but the listeners complained about the sound quality. And this is what that season sounded like.
This is Ken Carpenter welcoming you to So-Called Radio Time, produced and transcribed in Hollywood, and starring Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
Give me 5 minutes more, only 5 minutes more. Let me stay in your arms. Here am I begging for only 5 minutes more, only 5 minutes more of your.
So it doesn't sound that great.
But a lot worse than a live broadcast would have sounded.
A lot worse.
I see.
A lot worse.
The listeners just did not like it.
Yeah. And then tape comes along. And Bing, of course, would still like to record all of his shows in advance, and he wants to use this brand new technology. But NBC now is worried that the listening audience would ultimately object to programs that were taped. They thought that taping a show would also give Bing too much power over the content because he would be taping a bunch in a row without the censors looking over his shoulders.
Saying not enough soap jokes.
That's right. So they said no. But ABC at the time was a little desperate for some big stars, and they said, hey, you can tape your show over here. And Bing was off. On October 1st, 1947, Bing performed the very first show on the radio ever to be on tape.
Hey, Jerry, what are we sweeping up the studio for?
Bing Crosby is coming back on the air tonight.
Since when do we have to clean up a studio for him? With them baggy pants of his, he sweeps his own studio.
Hiya, fellas.
Well, Bing, hey, hello.
Oh, welcome home.
Hey, wait, thanks. Give me a hand with this, will you?
Huh? Who was that? Your brother, Everett?
No, that's a moose. He followed me down from Canada. Steady now, boy. Whoa, now. Steady there. Whoa, now.
A moose, eh? Where's Everett?
He's outside, strapped on the fender of my car.
That really sounds a lot different.
Doesn't
that's
it?
Remarkable.
Yeah, it really does. It turns out that NBC executives were also wrong about their fear that listeners wouldn't like stuff that was on tape. They didn't seem to mind. It's possible that they didn't even know, you know, because the sound quality was so good. And so he did all of his shows on tape. And once he had made taping a show acceptable, it started to take over a little bit.
Change the industry.
Yeah, and there was also another advantage. A taped show meant that the radio could be edited for the first time. And that was the fact that really changed the industry forever.
Why?
Because all of a sudden the studios are letting the radio audience, well, let's listen to how they let them know, and then I'll tell you why.
All right.
Studios let the radio audience know that the shows were taped by including this.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yeah, so transcribed.
That was the clue.
That's the clue. That means this is something that's taped and not live. Whether everybody listening knew that, I don't know. But ironically, Steve, I thought you'd appreciate this, that even though the show Johnny Dollar went from being live to being taped every day, the director, Jack Johnstone, who took over the show in the mid-1950s, insisted that if things were going to be recorded, they were going to be recorded live to tape. And that meant the actors had to perform it as if they were live on the air, run the script all the way through, and if they made a mistake, he would make them start completely over from the beginning.
Well, you say I would appreciate it because that's what I think we have. That's what we do.
That's what we do.
That's our rule.
Yeah. So embarrassing blunders.
If we mess up right here, that's going on the air.
Yep. And we already have a couple of times, I think. This was his personal preference as a director because tape editing at that point did exist. And that's what I was indicating before, the big change. Because of editing, we start to see things happening like radio variety shows that are performed in front of an audience now are running long so that they can cut out all the weaker moments that happen during the show. Wait, Don't Tell Me still does this.
Now, This American Life does it too, right? But does Garrison Keillor do it?
No.
Because you worked there.
Garrison Keillor is...
Well, he's live.
I can't say only.
But he's live. He's live when he's on Saturday. And they do a lot of rehearsal. That's right. So he's live and they do it to time.
That's right. And if they're running long during the course of the show, they're editing on the fly, not editing tape. But he'll walk off the stage and he'll talk to the stage manager and he'll say, I think we need to cut this song. I'm going to cut this page from the script that we're about to do.
Yeah, haven't you told me that when you were working there, that's what happened?
Almost every time. Because, you know, they're trying to fit into a certain time schedule. But when you're dealing with live musicians, sometimes things run long. So they would have a general estimation of how much each segment is going to take, how much time. So they say,
if they're running 4 minutes over, they know that, hey, that song Garrison was planning on singing, it's about 4 minutes. We can cut that out, and that will bring us back up to the right time.
That's interesting. Or I imagine they'll do a chorus and a verse and a chorus and a verse and get rid of the other ones.
I mean, another thing he does is that he'll have a radio script, and he'll cross out a whole paragraph and then slowly pass it down the row to the actors while they're doing the live part, live performance.
Oh, man, that's tough. All right, so what did it mean? So tape, higher quality, you don't have that transcription sound. We're sort of assuming when we're listening that things are live, happening live. I mean, All Things Considered is mostly a tape show. So is Morning Edition. That's mostly taped, especially by the time we hear it.
Yep. Weekdays mostly live.
Weekdays live, yeah. So, combos live, conversations
live.
Yeah,
it's just becoming fewer and fewer.
The takeaway right afterward is on tape. But what about To the Point? To the Point's mostly live at that point.
Yeah,
at 11 o'clock.
I don't know.
It's interesting.
It's interesting, too, because when you look back at the Golden Age, you also find incidences at this time of people starting to doctor comedy shows. So they're editing in bigger laughs. Things like that. So there is that fallback of tape, too, where you could be tempted to be very disingenuous.
You fake it.
Yeah, I could have, you know, everybody I ever interview say, that's a really great question, you know, something like that, just by some careful editing. So, but as usual, of course, when we're talking about the Golden Age of radio and we're talking about a big change like transcribed programs, there's going to be some comedian that wants to make fun of the changes.
The following is transcribed.
No, it isn't.
The following is transcribed.
No, it isn't.
Oh, yes, it is.
It is not.
Yes, it is.
It is not.
It is, too.
It is not.
It is.
It isn't.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
The following is not transcribed.
It's kind of hard to hear on that tape, but that is supposed to be a gunshot.
Oh, it's a gunshot? Oh, I thought he was slamming the door. Oh,
no.
That's harsh.
It's a gunshot.
It's All right, so Katie, don't shoot me, but resurrect me again for another old-time radio show.
I will, and I've got a really complicated one for you next week.
Good. Well, we'll make sure we do it live.
Yeah, we'll do it live or on tape.
This is Weekday.
Steve Scherr with Katie Sewell talking about old-time radio as they do every Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour. It's a few minutes before 11 o'clock, and that means on Thursdays that we check in with food writer Sarah Dickerman. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
So you are about to send us all to a butcher shop for lunch, correct?
You can actually see the sausage being made. Yes, well, you know, I don't know whether listeners know, but there's a great butcher shop on Capitol Hill called Rain Shadow Meats. And it's just a plain old butcher shop. But it's expanded now to Pioneer Square, as so many restaurants are right now. It's a really hot area for new development. Or new development in old buildings, I should say. And so the butcher shop's expanded, and now they have lunch there. They have great, as you might expect, they have great hearty sandwiches, really good cold roast beef with romesco sauce, which is sort of a red pepper and nut sauce. They have mortadella that they make in-house.
I have to ask what mortadella is.
It's kind of like bologna, like it should be. It's a very finely emulsified sausage. Theirs is on the spicy end. It doesn't have to be spicy. And it's a pretty complicated sausage to make, so it's pretty cool to have it home, house made. Mm-hmm. And they do that in a hot sandwich.
Yum. Yum.
And the key is if you're interested in what the men and women who are at work in the butcher shop are doing, you can sit at a little marble counter and watch them. And I think it's really interesting. You get to see them breaking down different animals or whatnot. But if that's not your style while you're eating.
I don't have to see that.
You don't have to. You can sit by the front windows and just know they're there behind you.
So that's Rain Shadow Meats. And you just sort of in passing said that a lot of new restaurants are going in the Pioneer Square area. But when you mentioned this, I can't help but think of a destination for lunch that's been there for a while, which is Salumi.
Oh, yeah. Always a great choice, too. And a great sandwich option here in
Seattle.
So
is Rain Shadow Meats going to take some of the line away so that you won't be waiting 2 hours to have some delicious sausage?
I don't know, or whether there'll just be more room for a line. It seems like the appetite for a delicious hearty sandwich is unending, and so I think there's room for more. I think there'll just be more lines, I'm afraid.
Okay, so that's Rain Shadow Meats Pioneer Square version. You cannot yet eat lunch at the Capitol Hill version of Rain Shadow Meats.
Not at this point, no.
But who knows? It might be so wildly popular. Some of us maybe are thinking about fruit, the advent of the early spring fruits, and that's what you want to talk about when it comes to cooking.
Yeah, it was because, you know, I compulsively buy rhubarb at this time of year because it's just, you know, the first thing you can get that's vaguely fruity. And I grabbed some, and looking for some inspiration, I turned to an author I really respect named Christine Ferber. She's an Alsatian jam maker and pâtissier, and her books have been translated into English. And they are they're just different from American cookbooks, and it gives you another level of panache to work into your tarts. And so I actually just made her rhubarb tart, which is like a rhubarb custard tart, and it's topped with a spiced meringue that you then brown in the oven.
Wow.
It's gorgeous. Like, it's a little complicated, but kind of worth hanging in there for. And a lot of the tarts are the same. She has both savory and fruity tarts. They go through the season.
Whoops, we're losing you there.
I'm sorry. They go through the seasons, and it's just a really inspiring book. And, you know, you can break down the components. If the individual presentation is too much, you can find a really interesting, the basics are interesting too.
Well, how are European tarts or maybe Alsatian tarts in general different from what we think of as American pies?
They're not generally double crusted. And she has a great variety in here. Alsatian tarts are famously usually have a little thin layer of custard to go with the fruit, which tastes with something like rhubarb. It's so good, that sour rhubarb with a slightly mellowing quality of a thin custard.
I noticed some of the, I get to look at your email. So here, green gauge plums with almonds, yellow peach clafouti, which is kind of a custardy pudding with lavender.
Yes.
So does this give you, I don't think I'd be that adventurous, but if I were to read Christine Ferber's book, Mes Tartes, they didn't change it to My Tarts in English. It's Mestartes. Is there room for me to try stuff myself as an experimenter? Would it give me inspiration?
Yes, I think if you're sort of a comfortable and competent baker, then I think you can add some interesting layers to your tarts. Say, you know, add a little lavender, even if you use your own peach pie recipe. You know, it just gives you a little latitude to experiment. And she just has such interesting combinations, adding herbs, adding flowers, just little doses that, or a little bit of caramelized nuts to the top of a tart, little grace notes that just elevate it.
So I see the pattern. What you do is you go to Rain Shadow Meats and buy one of your sandwiches to go, and then you've got your tart baked already in a picnic basket, because theoretically the sun is coming out today. I haven't seen outside yet. And you have a picnic, yeah?
It sounds perfect. What a delightful meal.
That sounds good. Sarah Dickerman's recommendation is Christine Ferber. It looks like Ferber in English, F-E-R-B-E-R, an English translation of her book, Mes Tartes, and Rain Shadow Meats in Pioneer Square, number 2. You can always just buy the meat at the original Rain Shadow. Sarah Dickerman, thanks for taking time to give us these couple of recommendations.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Dickerman writes about food at her website, sarahdickerman.com, as well as for publications like Bon Appetit, Slate, and the New York Times. And she gives us a lunch and cookbook recommendation most Thursdays here on Weekday. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell with Jason Pagano and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette is the man at, he's just the man at the helm. Just,
you're the woman, Marcy.
And we are a man and woman who are here every day at this time. I'm Marcy Silman. I'll be here tomorrow. We'll be here with our panel of journalists talking over the week's news and a look at gay marriage in at least one Washington State Indian tribe and how that's now legal for the first time.
All right. Well, Marcy just said a minute ago she hasn't seen the sun yet today, which is true. Neither have I. But
it's still cloudy.
Our friends at the National Weather Service say, have faith.
Okay, I'm
going
to.
We'll be sunny this afternoon.
Okay.
And we're
going
to get up to 73, supposedly. Currently, though, cloudy, still foggy in some places, and 53 degrees. 10:59. All Nippon Airways is restarting flights between Seattle and Japan, but not with the 787. KUOW's Lisa Brooks explains in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, presenting Obliteride, a fundraising bike ride uniting the community to accelerate life-saving cancer research. Registration for the August Ride to End Cancer is now open. More about riding, volunteering, and donations at obliteride.org.
Dementia costs and the number of people with dementia will more than double in 30 years, according to the RAND Corporation. What are your experiences with this? Are you caring for someone with dementia? You can help us understand. Call and leave a message at 206-221-3663. How are you handling the costs of dementia care? 206-221. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.